My name is Pete LePage. I'm one of the product managers on the Internet Explorer team. And so I'm going to run you guys through Internet Explorer 9 and HTML5 today. I'll give you a little bit of an intro about me so that you know where I'm coming from and who I am, what I do. So I'm one of the product managers. There's a bunch of us on the IE team back in Redmond. And I've been responsible for the developer audience for the last 3 years. I joined the IE product management team just before we shipped IE 7. So I've seen the browser grow from where it was in IE 7, where it did an okay job with standard support and got a little bit better in 8. And wow, that's awesome. Thanks. Now with Internet Explorer 9, with platform previews that we've done and all that, I consider myself sort of I don't do web development professionally, but I do a lot of it sort of in a hobby and spend a lot of time sort of just playing around, building some cool stuff for friends and that kind of stuff. So I spend a fair bit of time developing in that, and I try and do my best to do some good design stuff, but often don't do very well at that. I'm pretty good at admitting that. So if I can get this guy to work, maybe, come on. All right, there we go. So the plan for this afternoon, I'm going to sort of talk a little bit about the history and evolution of where the web has gone and where Microsoft sees it going and where we think the web sort of is today. Then talk about some of the things we've done to make IE faster, some of the things we've done to make the browser just get out of your way and be cleaner and put your sites at the center so that your site becomes the focus of what people are doing online, instead of, oh, well, you know, you've got this really big browsing experience and all that kind of stuff. And then finally, we'll talk about the interoperable stuff, all the HTML5, CSS3, the ECMAScript 5, for those folks who are familiar with ECMAScript 5. It's the new JavaScript standard. And when we think about the web many years ago, back in the 2000 time frame, this is the Microsoft website in I think it's about August of 2001, or sorry, February 2001, right? The web back in the early 2000s was really about content. It was all about you going and pulling stuff off the web, and you didn't really do any interaction with it. It was just, hey, I'm going to go read about this, and yay, isn't that great? And the web today has become much more interactive. You think of things like Facebook and Twitter and any of your social networking sites, or even, you know, some of the Microsoft MSDN, anything like that. It's a lot more interactive. There's a lot more places for you to go and provide content and give feedback, to share information with your friends and all of that. And that's going to continue as the web moves forward. But one of the things that the web really starts to do is it becomes much richer and much more interactive. Applications feel native. So the website that you go to today doesn't really feel like an application that's on your desktop, right? Like the Twitter website doesn't at all feel like any of the native Twitter applications. That's where we see things going, that the applications that you're running on the web feel like they're on your desktop, that they're native, that there's no sort of differentiation between sort of where the web is and applications. And so we started Internet Explorer 9 back in March with the first release of the platform previews. And the platform previews have gone amazingly well as far as we're concerned. We've had a huge number of downloads, over 2.5 million downloads of the platform previews. And the platform previews were our way to sort of start showing the new work that we're doing with Internet Explorer 9, the work we're doing with speeds and standard, but without having to sort of say, hey, here's what the new user interface looks like. And the other thing is, it lets you run them side by side. You can run the platform preview next to your Internet Explorer installation. How many folks have installed the platform preview? All right, so a bunch. It installs. It's super easy. Because it doesn't take up your Internet Explorer instance, I'd highly recommend you do it, because it does have that ability to just go play without having to worry about anything else. And then 2 weeks ago, we released the Internet Explorer 9 beta. Get gets out of your way, it's clean, fast, you can go do all the stuff that you want to be doing on it. As we started building IE9, as we looked at what the sort of things that we needed to do were, we looked at how we make the browser faster. And we spend a lot of time at Microsoft looking at data to understand how best to build a product, what things you and me as developers are need to make the next generation web. And so one of the things that we did is we actually went and we took the top 5 news sites worldwide, and we looked at the different systems that run across or within the browser to understand where the browser's spending its time. And we came up with some really interesting data that quite surprised us. If you look at that first column there, we spent a lot of time in the JavaScript engine. But over here on News Site 3, we spend very little time on the JavaScript engine. And we realized that, you know, if you've got one component that's really, really fast, your browser may be a little bit faster, but there's a lot of other components that spend a lot of time with running things. For example, News Site 2 spends a huge amount of time marshalling, right? And that marshalling is the conversation that happens between JavaScript and the DOM. It's that communication channel. So there's a lot of things that we need to do to make the browser run fast. If we make the JavaScript engine faster, but don't do the marshalling work, well, News Site 2 doesn't really get any advantages. But if we do work on any of the other stuff, we need to work all across the browser. It's not just one thing we need to make fast. We need to make a lot of things fast. And Internet Explorer 9, we did that in a couple of ways. The biggest one is we used the power of your whole PC. And I'll talk about what that means in a minute. But using the JavaScript engine, we wrote a brand new JavaScript engine that uses your whole PC to run faster. Right over here on the far left, we've got the IE8. This is the SunSpider benchmark result, right? So our numbers were a little bit not in sync with everybody else. We'll say that. All right. At PDC, we brought it down to just under 1,000 milliseconds difference between the JavaScript engines. In IE9 Platform Preview 3, we brought it down again. Well, here in Platform Preview 5, we've got it way down again. And the difference between these guys is about 70 milliseconds. All right? Now, when you're talking a difference of 70 milliseconds for a test that takes at least 70 seconds to run, the difference there is pretty minuscule. All right? In IE8, this is how the JavaScript engine worked in IE8, and I've never seen this big. This is kind of cool. It's bigger than my head. All right, so in IE8, the JavaScript engine would grab the source code, the parser would start working on it, it would run through a bunch of different things, but the end result was everything was just interpreted, right? Like line by line, chunk, 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 which is an okay way of doing it. And especially, you know, like if you look at what JavaScript was in the late 90s, the early 2000s, interpreting was fine. Nobody was really doing that much JavaScript on their sites. Well, today we need a faster JavaScript engine. With Internet Explorer 9, we actually will go and we pull down your code, and as soon as we've got your code pulled down, we're going to start compiling it. Once it's compiled, we're going to switch over to the compiled code. Which runs faster, compiled or interpreted? Compiled wins by a landslide every time. So, I talked about Internet Explorer 9 using your whole PC. Today, if you're browsing the web, you're probably only using about 10% of your PC, right? You're probably only using one core. It may be spreading stuff across, but like realistically, you're only using one core. You're not using the graphics components of your PC. You may have a great graphics card in there or just a decent graphics card. You're not taking advantage of those. With Internet Explorer 9, we built the browser to take advantage of the whole PC, multiple cores. So as we compile that code, we compile it on one of the alternate cores on your system. If you've only got one core on your system, well, we've got a bunch of optimizations around that, but we're compiling in the background. So that way, everything else still runs. We're still interpreting your code until we've got that compiled code ready. So you don't have to sit there and wait for the code to compile. Things just keep running. And so I'm going to pop out of here for a sec, and let me bring up, let's try it with Firefox today. All right, so this is the IE Test Drive site. If you've not checked it out, go check it out in whatever browser you want. All of our demos and examples on this site work in all of the browsers. And there's some neat things on here. One of the ones that I like is as we look at the flying images. So this is a demo that we wrote that shows off some plain simple HTML4, some CSS2.1, and JavaScript. It just takes these images and it simulates animating them, right? Like it just sort of grabs the DOM, moves each image, chunk, chunk, chunk. And Firefox does okay, and as we start adding images, now my fan has spun up a little bit right now. Oh, well, my speed dropped a little bit. I'm going to go add some more. Well, my frame rate drops pretty quickly here. And I'm really down to 20 frames per second because there's a lot of stuff going on. Try that same thing in Internet Explorer 9. And remember, this is just simple HTML4 and CSS2. I'll go just right up to 100 images. I still maintain my 100 frames per second, or my 60 frames per second at 100 images. IE9, because it's using a much faster JavaScript engine, that code is compiled, as well as the GPU to render these images and manipulate the images, things run much faster. The performance is much better. All right. So let's just take a quick look at what happens. In IE8, all right, each one of those lines represents a tenth of a second, and on the x-axis is the time. On the y-axis is the amount of CPU you're using for that amount of time. Green is JavaScript, purple is DOM manipulation, and yellow is rendering. So in IE8, it took like a half a second just to move those images one little bit. Anybody want to take a guess how much difference it is in IE9? Just shout a guess out. 10? Yeah. It's a little bit different, right? Like, because the code is already compiled, you don't have to do anything like that. Because we're using the GPU to manipulate those images, you don't have to use the CPU. We take less than half of the CPU for a tenth of a second. It's amazing how much faster this stuff runs. And I've been talking about the GPU and using the GPU to accelerate stuff. The GPU, everybody's got a GPU in their system. If you've bought a Windows PC in the last 8 years, there's a GPU in your computer. All right? And the GPU is awesome at figuring out how to handle graphics. It knows how to skew images or resize them and do all sorts of stuff much better than your CPU does. Your CPU can do it, right? They've been doing it for years. But the GPU is the custom hardware to do that. A lot of people, when they think of the GPU, they think of like the hardcore gamer GPU, like the one up on screen or something like that, like the really cool, expensive ones. Well, it's not always the case. I mentioned everybody's got one. You know, you may have a netbook. And in fact, my personal netbook that I usually travel with has a perfectly great GPU in it that does a really good job. GPUs have video hardware decoding built in. So if you're doing H.264 video, we'll talk about that when we get to video. All of that stuff is done on the hardware. It means you're not taking up CPU time. And we know that Windows customers have pretty good GPUs. We know that for most folks, they've got at least a 4. Because of the customer experience index program that you can say, hey, yes, I want to report my stuff. Completely optional, completely anonymous. We know that most folks have a pretty good GPU on their system. One of the other things we've done around performance is not so much in making the browser fast, but is helping you build faster websites. And it's a new set of APIs called Window.ms Performance. Window.ms Performance allows you to go in and right in the actual sort of guts of the browser, know when loads started, know when loads finished. In fact, I've got some code down here. So window.msperformance.timing.navigation.start gives you the time the navigation started, and then there's another one that's got navigation end, so you can know when your navigation ended. You no longer have to go instrument your code by hand and, you know, go in and put all those individual lines in there and say, you know, hey, I need a new variable for my time start and my time stop and all that kind of stuff, because this is built into the browser. Because it's built into the browser, it's much more accurate timing-wise, right? Because it's right there in the guts. The browser knows these things because it just does. But this is not just in Internet Explorer. We're working with the W3C to make sure that this goes in as a part of the W3C specifications. Google has already started working on this in their Chromium nightlies. You can go and try this. Now, because it's in Chromium, they're also using a vendor prefix, so obviously they're not going for the MS performance. They've got Chromium performance. But this is going to become a standard and eventually will be implemented across all the browsers. So it's going to mean you're going to be able to say window.performance and know the performance of your PC. So making sure that your applications work across all the browsers with the same markup, that you can understand your performance better, is really important to us, because it's important that not only is the browser fast, but you have the tools to make sure that your sites run fast as well. So I'll talk about some of the stuff we've done to make the browser clean. The browser is much cleaner. It gets out of the way. As we were thinking about how to talk about IE9 and the stuff that we did, one of the really important things that we sort of realized was the browser isn't really about the thing that people go do, right? When you go sit down at your computer, you're not like, ooh, yay, I'm going to run Internet Explorer today, right? And you're probably not going, ooh, yay, I'm going to run Chrome or Firefox or Safari. You're sitting down at your computer to go to the sites that you want, to go have the experiences on the sites. So we think of the browser not as the play or the thing that you're going to see, but as the stage. It's the place where your sites, the sites that I'm creating, have a place to shine. So you'll notice much smaller up at the top, right? We gave you a lot more space. We got rid of the status bar down at the bottom. There's a lot more space in terms of the actual rendering. I'm going to pop out of here. I'll bring IE up so that we can have a quick look. One of the things that I found fascinating as we were building the browser, again, looking at data, we looked at the number of tabs that people have open at any given time. And one of the things that we found out by looking at like tens of millions of users across hundreds of millions of sessions was people only have 3 or 4 tabs open at any given time. This is the average person. Right? I think probably some of us in this room are a little bit different, but average people only have 3 or 4 tabs open at any given time. So let's bring the tab bar up here, because you don't need a whole list of tabs going, taking up more space. Let's give you more space. We connected the address bar in the search box and turned it into what we call the one box, which gives you access to your favorites, gives you access to your history, gives you access to search. One of the things that we do differently, though, is we research your privacy, or we respect your privacy right out of the box. Unlike other browsers that will turn on the search suggestions by default, we don't do that. As I start typing in here, now, I apologize, this is not either in English or in anything else that maybe some of you guys could read, but it says, you know, turn on search suggestions now, so I have to actually go and turn on search suggestions to get that to work. And, of course, you know, you always have to have one thing that doesn't work in your demos, but you've got search suggestions that you can turn on and off just like that. So we're not going to go and send your stuff. It's your choice what you want to do, how you want to do that. All right. Yep, that. There we go. But one of the other things that we kind of realized was, as we talked to customers, most folks don't use their start menu. They are not their start menu, sorry, their favorites bar. In fact, less than 10% of people have actually ever put something on their favorites bar. How many people in this room have used their favorites bar or the equivalent in whatever browser you use? Yeah, we're a little bit different. For those of you who do use IE in the room, and I encourage you to at least give it a try again, because it is a completely different browser than it ever used to be. If you want your favorites bar back, you can just right-click on that area up in the tabs and say favorites bar, and it'll show up again. I've done it on mine. It's somewhat important for me. But as we talked to customers, we were surprised at how few use the favorites bar, but how many would pin applications to their taskbar in Windows. So we said, well, why shouldn't you be able to do that? If you've only got a few favorites, why not allow people to pin their applications to the taskbar? Well, if you can pin it to the taskbar, why can't it give you notifications as well? You know how, like, in Outlook, it'll say, hey, you've got a new mail or something like that? Why shouldn't that same thing happen in the browser? And we give developers a way that they can go and plug into that. You can also go and add buttons. And in fact, even add task jump lists so that you can go and get to your sites and go to do certain things on your sites much more easily than you ever could before. Bring up IE here. In fact, I won't even bring it up in IE. I'll go to Facebook. I can right-click on this, and I can see here's the favorites that Facebook has already defined for me. I can go and check out my news, and hopefully none of my friends have said anything too rude, and looking like I'm okay there, all right? So you can go straight into your news. And Facebook has gone and implemented that thing telling me, hey, I've got new messages or new information that I want to go to. Twitter's done it as well. I can go and say, new tweet. And it'll take me up here and I can say, hello from Helsinki. And I can go tweet that. Quick, easy way. I can go in and get into any of my direct messages. It's a much faster way to be able to do that stuff. Now notice the browser looks a little bit different than IE. In fact, what we do is we grab the favorite icon that you've got, that you've already defined, all right, on your page, and we put that right here. We also change the color of the back and forward button so that it feels a little bit more like the sites that you're using today. It feels like a slightly branded experience. Right? As a designer or developer, you can choose the colors of those buttons. You can do that however you want. That's up to you. If you don't define it, we'll just grab it from your favorites icon. If you want to pin an application, let me just sort of unpin Facebook here so that we can see how you do that. Unpin this. I'll bring up IE. And I'll go on over to Facebook. So here's the Facebook experience, right? I'm not pinned right now, so I've got the default colors and all that. I can do it one of two ways. I can either grab the little favorite icon and just pop it on down here, and sure enough, I've got the experience open. It opens in a new tab, so you've got tab isolation that if something else over in another browser window crashes the browser for whatever reason, that's going to stay up and going to keep running. All right. To get pinned sites to work, you don't need to do anything. They just work by default out of the box with no changes. People can just grab your application, grab that favorite icon, bring it on down, and it works. But there are ways that you can customize those applications. If you want to provide the jump lists are just a couple of lines of meta tags. One for each, one meta tag for each line that you want to add. You can customize the icon. You can add the little icon overlay if you want. So you can enhance that experience. The great thing is, this is not some, you know, like, oh, you have to go write crazy code to get this to work, or you have to change your website. If you've got a standards-based website today, this just works. You just add those meta tags. It's not going to make your website not render or anything like that. So to get the sites to work, you can add these things. These are all optional if you want to go add them. Application name, that's what appears on the when you hover over the icon down on the taskbar. The start the pinned app, the MS tooltip, that's the tooltip that's going to show up. And then the application start URL. So that way it always starts on your home page. If the user goes and they pin it from some other page, but you always want them to end up on your home page, it's the first place, you can add that, which tells them, hey, always come to my home page as my home application. You can also pin the sites programmatically. Now, you can't pin it to the taskbar programmatically, but you can pin it to the start menu programmatically. And there's a couple APIs here. So window external MS is site mode. One of the best practices when building any kind of application, web application, is to make sure that you're using feature detection, not browser detection, right? Because browsers may fix things, they may do things differently if they update something. So doing feature detection is the best practice for that. You can do feature detection by saying window external MS is site mode without any brackets. That's going to return a true or false value whether that browser that your customer's coming into supports site mode. If it does, you can then check to see if the site is already in site mode. All right, and that's the second line there. Window external MS is site mode, open bracket, close bracket. That's going to tell you if you're in site mode or not. If you are, you can either do nothing or you can do something. Say, hey, thanks for being in site mode. Like, let me give you an extra couple bonus points or something like that, whatever. To add it to the start menu, you just use window external MS add site mode. All right. Now, we're not going to go and just shove it on in there. Of course, we're going to prompt the user with a, hey, this site wants to pin itself. Do you want to do that? User says yes or no. So that way, there isn't an opportunity for abuse. We want to make sure that customers get that opportunity to choose whether they want to do that or not. All right. There we go. Adding icon overlays. So when you've got your icon, you might want to provide that new mail notification or notification that, hey, there's something going on that you should go pay attention to. MS site mode, set icon overlay. You have the icon and then the text that you want to appear when the user hovers over that. So you might want to say, hey, you have 12 new email, all right? Or there's a new reminder. Because, you know, this is amazingly powerful in ways of staying in contact and connected with your customer, even if they've taken their browser and they've brought Solitaire up and they're playing Solitaire instead of, you know, on your website. You can think of in an enterprise scenario where I may have to approve my employees' expense reports. I can have something pop up to say, hey, I need to go have a look at this. Web-based mail. You've got new mail, right? Adding jump lists. These are just a couple meta tags that you need. They're the five icons that appear there. And MS application task, content, name equals task one. That's the first one you want to appear. You've got a URL and an icon. All right? And you can have up to five of those. You can have another custom jump list that'll have up to 12 that'll change dynamically as you program it. I don't have the code for that one here, but it's another one that you can go and do to actually make things work pretty well. All right, so interoperable. This is where we start to get to some of the neat HTML5 and CSS3, ECMAScript 5 stuff. And as we started building I9, it was important to us to understand what you're using today so we can make sure we get that stuff. In addition to implementing the HTML5 and CSS3 stuff. And so we wrote this application that went and scanned the top 7,000 websites around the world, and it came back and gave us a list of all the APIs that you're using on your sites and gave us a frequency of that usage. Coming in at number one was clearly, like it just won by far, was index of. Number 13 was get element by ID. The first one that we didn't support didn't come in until number 27 at Ad Event Listener. The second one we didn't support didn't come in until number 62 at 26%. All right, so we want to make sure that we're adding the right set of support and the right features. So just to sort of answer those, we've done both of those. We have full DOM Level 2 and DOM Level 3 events. We've got all the DOM style stuff, which is the get computed style in IE9. So you can see that we've got a fairly great level of support for that. And we're working with the W3C to make sure we do a fantastic job in implementing these things and making sure that we have a voice and that you as our customers and web developers have a voice, because it's important to make sure that we get the ambiguities out of the spec before the spec gets finalized. Right? If there are ambiguities in a spec, what do we do? Like, well, Microsoft might pick one thing and Firefox is going to pick something else and Chrome is going to pick something else, and then all of a sudden that concept of same markup just doesn't work. So by working with the W3C, we're highly involved and engaged with these guys to make sure we get great specs that are wonderful for us as browser implementers, but are also really good for you as web designers and web developers. So, you know, I won't sort of list off and go through a lot of what we do within the W3C, but the HTML working group is, I think, one of the biggest ones that we're involved in, and one of the most important ones. The HTML Working Group has over 40 member organizations who participate in that working group. There's over 411 participants. There's over 280 invited experts. The invited experts are people who don't come from the browser vendor world. They come from folks like you. They're people like Andy Clark. They're people who are out there designing and developing websites every day, who are sort of in the trenches with you and know how, when they want to do something, this is how they think about approaching it, so that we can make sure that we approach these things in a way that makes sense. We're leading a number of task forces within the HTML working group. One of the task forces that we're leading is the testing task force. In order for the HTML5 spec to exit the editing mode, or the development mode, it actually needs to have, and this is what the formal definition is, needs to have two interoperable implementations. Now, how the heck do you have an interoperable implementation unless you have a test suite? So the testing task force is tasked with going and creating a test suite that we can ensure that we have an interoperable test suite that all of the browser vendors can agree to. So this is not like, hey, Microsoft saying, this is the test suite. This is all of us working within the W3C to create a test suite that we all agree to. So when we say same markup, well, this is what we mean. That your code, your markup that you write works the same in every browser and looks the same. This is all of the browsers trying to render a rounded corner. All right, so the border is set to dashed. We've got rounded corners, and we have a border width of 42 pixels. Now, this doesn't look the same in all the browsers. And in fact, the code is not even the same in all the browsers. In Opera and in Chrome and Safari, all right, it looks pretty much the same, but they don't respect the spec that says, hey, you can say in your rounded corners, you can say top right, top left, bottom right, bottom left, just like you can for padding, where you can define all four in one line. Well, so they don't do that. Firefox does a slightly better job in that regard, but with them, you've got to use the vendor prefix, so you've got to add dash moz. Well, and then start looking at what the dashes in that look like. Well, you know, Mozilla Firefox actually does a pretty good job of doing their dashes, except for the fact they don't dash in corners. So if you go look at their implementation, they look great, their dashes are pretty good, as long as they're not in the corners. As soon as you get into the corner, you get a solid line. The other browsers do an okay job, but it's not consistent in how the dashes look. right? It's important. Are you going to ship a website to your customer that has dashes that look like this, right? Where the dashes aren't equal or even? So it's important to us that when we do implement something, we do a really great job. So that way, you're not coming back to us and saying, oh, look at Microsoft. They're doing a crappy job of implementing standards. We want to make sure we do a rock-solid job in implementing this stuff. So one of the ways we're doing that is we're making our test suite that we're building available to the W3C. All right. So in IE8, we wrote over 7,200 test cases for the CSS 2.1 implementation. We're doing that same thing in IE9 with HTML5, with CSS3, with JavaScript, with DOM. Now, actually, you can read that. So, like, we've got 99 tests that we've donated already. All right. Now, that's just the beginning, right? There's no way you can test that spec with just 99 tests. But these are the tests that we're giving over to the W3C. The W3C then has a process for taking them in. All the browser vendors and all the folks on the testing task force have to say, yep, we agree, this is a good test. And then it gets moved over to the test suite. You can try the test suite out for yourself. It's not pretty, right? Like, you're not going to get this beautiful bar graph that goes, ooh, your browser passes 56 out of 70 tests, right? It just lists all the tests off and whether it says pass or fail. But it's super important because there's no way you can do all of those tests in like one web page with like, oh, yep, yay, isn't that one a wonderful little infographic that sort of makes you feel like your browser passes or fails? It's hard to do that. So HTML5, quick overview, and then we'll jump into like the cool stuff from HTML5. When folks talk about HTML5, it can mean a lot of things, right? Like, are you talking about the HTML5 specification from the W3C? Are you talking about the HTML5 specification from the What Working Group, which is a completely separate standards organization that's not really recognized as a standards organization by standards bodies, but it's a group of folks who started working on the HTML5 spec a while ago. Are you talking about all of the sort of new web technologies that could mean HTML5, like geolocation or other things that aren't actually in the W3C spec? All right. When we talk about it, typically we're talking about the W3C HTML5 spec and any of the specs from the W3C. The HTML5 itself adds a bunch of new rich media and graphics capabilities like canvas and video and audio and all that kind of stuff. And it also standardizes behavior, not just in the correct behavior, but one of the things that it does is standardizes on incorrect behavior. So if it says, if you come across bad code, this is what you should do. That's something that the HTML4 spec didn't do, which is kind of important, because everybody in this room writes perfect code. I can tell just by looking at you, right? Yeah, we all do that. Yeah. But not everybody writes perfect code. Sometimes you're working in a CMS system that your code's perfect, but the CMS is going to go and goof stuff up for you. So standardizes the behavior. But it's also a draft. It's still being edited, and it's changing every day. All right? Today, when I last looked back in July to try and just print it, I wasn't actually going to hit print, but I was kind of curious to see, go to print preview and see how many pages it was. It's over 1,100 pages long. So to try and implement something like that that's constantly changing is a fun little task. I'll say that. All right. Now, I'm done with that because I think this is much more fun. HTML5. All right. So this is my sort of like everything you wanted to know about HTML5, but were afraid to ask. And I want to do a little pop quiz, all right? Kind of seems appropriate. We're out of university and in a lecture hall, though usually I'm sitting at the back of the room sound asleep, or at least that's what I was doing when I was in school. What's in the HTML5 spec? So the W3C HTML5 spec. Are there any on there that jump out at you as you're positive that they're in the HTML5 spec? All right. Any that you think are not in the HTML5 spec? That's another good question. All right, well, so there's some really interesting stuff, right? Like, I'll just share the answers with you right now. The stuff in white is in the HTML5 spec. The stuff in black is not in the HTML5 specification. So there's a bunch of new elements. I sort of mentioned some of those earlier, but like footer and header are new elements that are supported in HTML5. The canvas element, oddly, is in the HTML5 spec. But the canvas implementation is not. It's its own spec. All right? SVG is the same way, where the SVG tag is in the HTML5 spec, but SVG isn't. There's absolutely no mention of any codecs in the HTML5 spec. So it doesn't say you must support the following video or audio codecs. It just says, this is the video tag, this is all the attributes on it, this is what it should do. So there's no spec that says, hey, you have to support the following codecs. Web workers and web sockets, again, not in the HTML5 spec from the W3C. I mentioned things change. The web storage APIs used to be in the W3C spec, or W3C HTML5 spec, but it's not anymore. So let's take a look at the document structure. Some things have changed, and some for the good, some for the interesting. It's HTML. It's not XHTML or it's not XML. All right. If you still want to write in that method, you're absolutely right to. You know, it doesn't say you can't do this. There's a new doc type. The new doc type, like, how many people could, like, quote for me the HTML4 strict doc type? Anybody? Yeah, like I thought. Like, that's one of those things that your tool either puts it in for you, or you go to one of the websites you've already built, and you copy it, and you paste it onto your new website. Because writing that sucker out is not easy. New HTML5 doc type. Doc type, HTML. Little easier. Overlapping tags are allowed. Right? So if you had before, you had to have nested tags because it was XML. Now you can have tags that are not nested. You can have overlapping tags. You don't have to have quotes. Makes things a little bit easier in some ways. In some cases, you're still going to need them. If you've got class equals quote and you want to have multiple classes, you need the quotes. But if you've only got one class on an element, you don't need quotes around that. I'm going to come to binary attributes last, but capitalization doesn't matter. All right? So one of the things that HTML5 does is it loosens all those document structure rules. You don't have to be as strict with your code as you used to. At the same time, just because the parents are away doesn't mean you should just throw a house party, right? Like, use the same rules that you're used to using. If you have a style or a style guide or you've got a way that you've learned to program and write your markup, stay with that. All right? Because if you get away from that, or, you know, you have to hand your code off to somebody else, do you want to hand them off code that looks like this and this and all that other stuff? You want to make sure that your code is easy to read and well written. So just because your parents are away, don't throw a big party. With binary attributes. This one goofed me up when I first came across it. Binary attributes basically means if the attribute is there, the value is true. All right? If the attribute is not there, the value is false. If you want to keep writing, you know, sort of the same way that you've been writing code before, where you don't really want to deal with binary attributes, you can say, in this particular case, video controls equals true. You could say controls equals hi, mom. You could say controls equals blah. What happens if you write controls equals false? Anybody want to take a guess? No controls. I got somebody saying no controls. Anybody want to say yes, you do get controls? All right. You do actually get controls. No matter what you set the value to, you get the controls. If the binary attribute is there, it's on. All right? So when you start looking at some of these binary attributes, you may get a little messed up, and if you go trying to figure out, like, I've set it to false, why is it not working? It's because it's there. All right. Pages don't have to be quite as strict as they used to be. That first page, or that first four lines of code, actually validates as far as the HTML5 validator is concerned. There's no HTML, there's no head, there's no body, but it still validates. Browsers know what's in the head and what's in the body. They know how to figure that out. They can deal with that. So by removing that, we've made things a little easier. But again, I'll go back to the comment I made earlier. If you've got a style guide and you're doing what you're used to doing and you know what's the right way to go, stay with that. So best practices, use the doc type. In the HTML element, set the language. Because you want to make sure that if you have users who are coming in with any accessibility readers or anything like that, you want to make sure that they have the right language set so that if they've got a screen reader turned on, the screen reader is going to read in the right sort of language. Then from there, head, title, adding the meta tag, again, very important. The meta char set, super important, because if you don't add that, there's potential that you can set yourself up for a cross-site scripting vulnerability. All right? We've probably all seen Twitter over the last week, and I'm sure they have it set, but yeah, they've been had a few problems this last week, right? So just trying to eliminate all the things that you can to eliminate any potentials for cross-site scripting vulnerabilities, super important. There's a bunch of elements that are, I've said, gone but not forgotten. One of the really important things about HTML5 is that it has to be backwards compatible. It's got to work with the websites that you built today or yesterday, 6 months ago or 6 years ago. So these elements don't go away, but we say, hey, guys, don't use them. All right? Applet, use embed instead. Big, blink, center. All of the elements that sort of were used in the past to define style on a page instead of, you know, semantic markup are gone. You know, I don't think we really need an excuse to say marquee is gone, but it's gone. Right. If you ever want to see something funny, if you ever see me speaking at a conference or an event, go look at my bio, because in my bio I said Pete's been around the web for many, many years, has been around since like Blink and Marquee were still cool. Well, some people, when they copy and paste my bio onto their web page, forget to change the tags, and all of a sudden my bio starts blinking and scrolling across the page. Yeah. Oops. They did it on the TechEd website this year. And like you can imagine, the TechEd website gets a lot of hits. Oops. All right. What's changed? There's a bunch of elements that have changed. I'm not going to read through all of these, but ordered list was deprecated in HTML4. It's back in HTML5. The other one that I want to call out is small. And small changes from the meaning of, hey, there should be a little text, right? To, this is the fine print or the small print on a page. We don't break websites as part of HTML5. So all of these things, even though they've been redefined, their look and feel isn't going to change. That small, if you're using it on your page today, still looks small. It's still going to use a small font. All right, so it's not going to change the semantic part of stuff. Bunch of new structural elements and a bunch of new fun elements. Fun is subjective. I think they're kind of fun. We'll get into those here in a moment. Bunch of new form elements. Quickly being able to go and style form input. Arturo was showing earlier, hey, I want to be able to have a phone number show up. When you're entering a phone, well, there's an element for that. There's my mouse. There you go. You can say tell. We don't support these in IE9 right now, so you just get a text box. And most of the other browsers don't support these right now. And there's a couple of reasons for that. How do you validate or some of these things internationally. It makes for a little bit of a challenge. It's not impossible, but it makes for a fun and interesting challenge. The second part is the look and feel of these things. As designers and developers, when we build our website, if we have a calendar control on our page, we probably want that calendar control to look and be themed like our website so that it matches our corporate branding or our personal website or whatever. Well, if you have the browser pop up a calendar control that you can't style, maybe not exactly what you want, and especially if it looks different in different browsers and different input types and all sorts of different things. So there's a bunch of things to work out here, but these are kind of interesting and kind of cool. So audio and video tags. Add a way, like, if you know how to add an image tag to your page today, you know how to add an audio tag or a video tag. It's pretty easy, and it's a quick way to be able to go and through JavaScript program these things and make them do what you want. You no longer have to rely on Silverlight or Flash to add video to your pages. You can still do that, and in fact, you can do that as fallback if the user is coming in on a browser that doesn't support them. So in IE9, we support the MP3 and AAC codecs for audio, and we support the H.264 video codec out of the box. If you have the WebM video codec installed on your machine, we'll support that as well out of the box. So those are the two big codecs. I've got some code here to show you the audio tags. By the way, these slides are all in HTML, and these slides are all up on my website. Let me just grab something here so that you can kind of see what I'm talking about. So this is all in HTML. These are up on my website. We'll send the link out to you guys after the event so you can go play with these and see how they work. So the audio tag, you just add audio, and I've just done this one. I've said ID equals my audio, and you've got the close audio tag. To deal with this programmatically, I've just used some JavaScript. So I've got audio source, where I just specify my source file. Then I've got a player, and I do get element by ID and grab that element. Set the source, and I set an attribute. The auto load attribute is one of those binary controls. JavaScript doesn't introduce a way to be able to go and add a binary control to an element. So I just said auto load, comma, auto load, so that auto load is my second value, or the actual value of the attribute auto load. With this one, I don't have any controls. So I can go here, if I hit play, right, you can hear a little bit of music playing, fireflies. I'll hit pause. You can pause it, you can go through, you can adjust the volume on it programmatically. The other option that you can do is that you can have controls show up. So on that one, I've said controls. And with that, I get a set of controls. The controls look different in each browser, so you want to keep that in mind as you go design your website. But now I can go and I can hit play over here. Oops. Right? And I get the controls. I get this little slider. I can see where the time is. I can see the total time. I can mute it. And I still have access to it through JavaScript. So if the controls are there, I can still control it through JavaScript. I have one big favor to ask of you guys. Please don't have music auto-start on pages when I go to them. Allow the user to choose that. Like, does anybody here like when music automatically starts on a page? Yeah. So, Pandora's or some music playing site is probably about the only one that you want to do that. So just don't do that, please. Even if your customers, the folks who you're developing sites for want that, just be like, oh, yeah, we can't do that. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. All right, video. So video is very similar. Video, same thing. You've got a video tag. I've got the ID. I've set a width on that particular element. You want to make sure that you set a width and a height because you notice as that page loaded, all right, there was a poster, and then the page had to sort of redraw to move up. If you don't put that size in there, the page is going to have to redraw once it's pulled the video down. So it's important to have that size in there so that the browser knows how much space to keep as it's pulling that file down. Again, same thing. I set my source. and then set attribute auto load. Again, you can have all sorts of other controls in there or other properties in there. You probably only want to set auto load if you're pretty confident the user's going to hit play. Because otherwise, you know, if you put auto load, it's going to start downloading that video file. And if there's only a 10% chance the user's going to hit play, like, why bother downloading that whole file if they're not going to watch it? Because it's expensive bandwidth-wise for you, and it's expensive bandwidth-wise for them. You've got the same set of APIs where you can be like, hey, I want to go hit play. Right? And you get H.264 video running. You can hit pause, just like you can with any other video. You can add the controls later if you want, right? So the controls aren't on this. I move my mouse over this guy. Oop, that wasn't what I wanted. There we go. If I want to add the controls, I can add them programmatically. So I just hit the controls button, and sure enough, there are the controls that pop up. Right? The controls go away, obviously, if I go off the video. Now, with HTML5 video tag, there's a couple of things that you can do that are cool and funky. We support the H.264 video tag, as does Apple and Chrome. All right, but Firefox and Opera don't support it. So for them, you need to use a different video. The video tag allows you to have multiple source files. So you can put your source file in here, where I've said optional. You could say source space src equals and point to your first one. If it doesn't support that, it's going to try and grab the second similar tag or similar element where it says source equals or source src equals, and you could put the AUG video file in. That way it's going to try and grab the first one first, it's going to try and grab the second one. If neither of those two go in and work, it's going to just keep going down the list of video files that you try and provide. If the browser doesn't support video, so say for example you're in IE8, you're in i7, i6, hopefully not, but some browser that doesn't support video, you can put in here your Flash or Silverlight fallback. So you can encode the video in Silverlight and put the Silverlight tag in there and say, hey, look, I've got Silverlight. What time am I supposed to go to?
We have 10 minutes.
Okay. All right. All right. CSS3 borders and backgrounds. I mentioned rounded corners earlier. Multiple backgrounds on elements so that you can have this multiple backgrounds here. This gray box is just it's an image that I've added so that you can have multiple backgrounds on a page. Web fonts. This one's actually kind of cool, I think. One of the things that we've done as part of Internet Explorer 9 in the release is we created a site called Beauty of the Web. And in fact, let me bring that up real quick. So Beauty of the Web is a website that we built in HTML5 and CSS3 to show off all the new cool stuff that IE9 has to offer. And one of the things that it has to offer is a lot of really awesome web experiences that you can go check out. All of these work in all of the modern browsers. We don't lock you out if you're not running IE9. We do say, hey, you know, we built this for IE9, but we still let you come in. So there's a lot of very cool and fun experiences. When you click on one of these, so like if I click on Twitter here, by the way, all that animation was done in HTML and CSS. There's no Flash on this page anywhere. And you can click on Visit Site. So one of the sample sites that was built by some of the guys at HappyCog and A List Apart and An Event Apart, if you're familiar with that. And they went and actually built a website that takes advantage of WAF fonts. If you're familiar with WAF fonts, it's a way that you can add fonts to your page without having to go and do anything crazy like images. These are all fonts. I want to go and click on this. It goes. It'll load the page. All of these are individual fonts that are downloaded onto your computer specifically for this page. You're no longer locked into having, you know, only the web safe fonts or having to rely on graphics for fonts. awesome, quick, easy way to be able to do that, which gives a lot more power to designers and developers. Ah, oops. All right, let's just pop over here. Media queries, I'm going to sort of skip over this one, but let me put it this way, super quick. You can apply CSS dependent on device properties. So in this particular case, you can apply it based on the width of the screen. So you can have a different set of CSS files if the user's coming in on a mobile device or on a netbook or on a desktop and they've got a really wide screen. It means you only have to write your site once, your HTML once, and you can apply different CSS depending on the device. CSS3 selectors, a set of APIs that you can go in and use JavaScript and your CSS syntax to select elements. In this particular case, I've said, hey, grab the P under the H2, and I want you to turn it red. Done. All right. Now, that's kind of a contrived example, but look at that first line, var element, query selector all. Grab all the unordered lists, grab the list items underneath that, but grab the nth child, odd. So only grab every other one. Now set the color to red or do whatever to it. Now you can stylistically or programmatically style your table so that they've got alternating row colors and things like that. HSL colors, it's a different color model that's much more flexible in choosing colors because you can choose from, you can pick the color, change the lightness or the saturation. I'm going to just real fast here. Let's go zero. So the hue is on the color circle from 0 to 360, where 0 or 360 is red, 120 is green, and 240 is blue. You can set the intensity of the color, 100 being pure color, 50% being sort of half the color, 0 being gray. I'm going to set this just to 100. Lightness, 0 to 100, 0 being sort of black, there is no light, 100 being white, there's pure white. So 50 is right in the middle. And then alpha transparency, A, is the whether it's see-through or not. So at 1, it's completely opaque. At 0.5, you can see halfway through it. You can change that value again. 0.1, and you can change that color so that you can get different color overlays on stuff. The opacity property works the same way. So if you want to set the opacity on something, you can do that. I somehow don't think it's 84 and rainy in Seattle right now, but it is probably rainy. Set it to 1. You can't see through that particular div at all. A whole bunch of new JavaScript stuff. ECMAScript 5 is the new JavaScript standard. All right, just was ratified back in December. And it's a way that allows you to specify all of the new, a whole bunch of new array stuff. There's also a bunch of new properties. But it also standardizes the behavior between different browsers. DOM storage, something we had in IE8, so I'll skip that. Canvas and SVG. Canvas allows you to draw on a page. So remember I said earlier, Canvas in the HTML5 spec is just sort of like there's the canvas element and then there's the canvas spec. So the canvas element, when you put it on a page, just gives you a box. Yay, well, we have a box. Whoop-de-doo, right? Through JavaScript, you can then draw on it. All right. Now, how many folks remember logo? You know, the little, like, turtle guy? Yeah. And turtle, you tell turtle to walk, you tell turtle to move. Canvas is similar. It's not exactly the same in that you can say, hey, I want to draw this. I want to do this. You can also add images to the page so that you can say, hey, I want to add this image or video to a page. And then you can do stuff with that video. All right. It allows you to manipulate pixel by pixel or by chunks of pixels. But once the browser has drawn that line, there's no way to access that line again unless through JavaScript you go in and modify it. All right. So this is a little bit of my code. So I say context, document get element by ID, my canvas. I say get context 2D, and then begin drawing my smile. Oh, I guess it helps if I hit next and then hit try it. And there's my little canvas. So I just drew that little guy. Unlike SVG, because once the browser has drawn it, it forgets about it, I can't change the color of that eye or anything like that. SVG is a little bit different in that vector markup or vector images allow me to just write my vectors or my SVG right in my page. So, you know, here's the SVG that's on the page to get this guy to work. There's a couple things to note. Because it's in your page, it's in your markup, just like any other elements, you can add events to it. So here we go. We've got onClick, alert, hello. Woohoo! I can add events to it. But I can also, because it's in the page, I can go grab it. And, you know, this red, I feel like making this red green. And through the developer tools, you can edit your markup live without having to change stuff. This is one of the big things that we, big changes we've made in IE9 for the JavaScript, or for markup. We've also added a new network tab that'll show you all of your network requests as they go through the page. So in fact, if I turn this on and hit back, you can see all of the requests that get made on the page. All right, so I'm going to pop back to my slides. So, using the hardware acceleration, you get hardware accelerated HTML5, but as well, if you've got any other HTML markup on your page, that's all accelerated. There's a whole whack of stuff. Bunch of new JavaScript stuff. I mentioned some of these earlier, but like full DOM level 2 and 3 events, DOM style, DOM core, XHTML parsing enhancements and HTML5 parsing enhancements. Lots of great stuff there that are going to make our lives as developers much easier. There's the new developer tools. I mentioned those already. This is sort of the wrap-up slide, but we're using the power of your whole PC, right? Whether it's multiple cores, whether it's the GPU, we want to make sure that the browser runs fast and that the sites that you have just rock. We want to make sure that we get out of the way so that your sites are the thing that the web is really about. It's not about the browser. It's about the awesome stuff that you guys build every day to give customers great experiences. But it's also about making sure that you write it once and it just works across all your browsers. So as you start playing with your sites in IE9, if the sites don't work and things look a little bit weird, it may be because you're trying to give it the IE8 or the IE7 markup. Just try giving it the exact same markup that you give to Firefox or Chrome or Safari, and you'll find that it probably works a heck of a lot better. If you haven't already downloaded it, give it a try. You can get it at beautyoftheweb.com. You can get the platform previews at ietestdrive.com. The platform previews install side by side, and the IE9 beta will replace your Internet Explorer 9 instance. Give your sites a try. Try building some new cool stuff. If you go to msdn.com/IE, we've got a really great sort of, we're calling it a cookbook, but that walks you through all of the new features and stuff that we've introduced in IE9, whether that's all the new markup and HTML5 and CSS3 stuff, or the pin site stuff. Everything's in there, and there's lots of great resources. We want your feedback. If you find bugs, if you find things that don't work exactly like you expect them to, go to httpconnect.microsoft.com/IE and tell us about it. The only way that we're going to make sure that we are just rock solid is not only through our testing team, but it's through your help. We need your help to make sure that our browser works the way you expect it to. So whether it's an HTML5 or CSS3 or JavaScript thing, or whether that's, you know, hey, when I click on the new tab, it takes me and does something that I don't expect, tell us about it. With that, I think I've got like a minute or so for questions. Otherwise, I'm happy to hang out and for a good little while and have conversations with you guys. So thank you. Are there questions?